Welcome to A Gram of Hope. I'm your host, Jerome Graham. On today's episode, we're speaking with the legendary Bishop Robert Culp, who is affectionately known as Toledo's Bishop. Bishop Culp, how are you?
I'm fine.
All right, man. It's great to have you in person on the podcast. Doc, you've been so instrumental in influencing so many people, and I personally express my gratitude because you shaped our family's future. My mother was a member of your church when she was a much younger woman. She's gone home to glory now, but she really needed some direction, and a good pastor does that. A good pastor gives direction and looks into a parishioner's being, so to speak, and sees the future. An opportunity came along for a nursing program, and my mother listened to you, got into the nursing program, and that allowed us to move from one neighborhood to a much better neighborhood. We were one of the few families that had a whole Encyclopedia Britannica. And not only that, we had Funkenwagnalls as well. So I am grateful to you. I'm grateful for your influence. But we're not going to take up the time just talking about what you did for me, although I could. But you've helped so many people along the way. And man, I'm glad that God blessed us to be able to have this opportunity. So in 61,
yes,
you came into Toledo.
Moved to Toledo, yes.
In 63, they had the March on Washington.
Right.
How was it starting out with so much going on? Because there were a lot of events that were taking place in that area, and you were a new pastor at that time?
Right. Well, new to Toledo.
New to Toledo.
I had pastored for 4 years in Danville, Illinois.
How was it coming to Toledo from the great state of Illinois? Well, did you even know that was a Toledo?
Actually, I had to resign from my Danville pastorate because to complete my seminary work, I had to move back to Indiana for 6 months, which I did do. And that's the reason that I was so available. I had to be in seminary full time in order to graduate. I had driven back and forth. I was just a youngster in his early 20s, so it didn't bother me a great deal to travel. It was 120 miles from Danville to Henderson. I had to make the drive twice a week here. But I wanted to get a good education, and I knew that I could get that there in Anderson, so I did that.
Did you have athletics in your prayer view? Did you basketball or anything like that? Or
yes. That was very much a part of my life. I had a younger brother who also went to the same school in Anderson. We went to the same high school. If you go back to Western Pennsylvania, a little town called Sharon, you'll find that in Mercer County, Pete Culp, my brother, is in the Hall of Fame.
Really?
We went to the same college. You'll find that Robert Culp, who is not in the High School Hall of Fame, is in the College Hall of Fame. The good Lord just decided to, I guess, enhance my gift. And I not only went through college on an athletic scholarship, but to be honest with you, I've traveled to almost 30 countries playing ball as a Christian athlete, sponsored by Youth for Christ International.
So people don't really realize that sports can influence you, or you can be influenced by sports as a minister.
Oh,
you
yes.
Don't just have to do one or the other.
Right.
And I would imagine that was an outreach opportunity.
Yes, Very much so. And we reached an awful lot of people. You know, for this group, or that particular group, we met famous people, and at that time, didn't we? Chiang Kai-shek, his wife was one of the sponsors of the program.
Mm-hmm.
So we had dinner with them, and you know, to us, that was just something you had to put up with, eating some strange food, you know, and acting like you're enjoying it. But we had excellent outreach and opportunity, and we won 80 out of 81 basketball games. And the only one we lost was in Korea to a group, I'm sorry, but it was to a group of communists. And the missionary told us if we wanted to get out of there alive, we better lose that game. That's actually what we had to do. We, the only game we lost, we had to lose it.
Well, sometimes you just got to understand the rules of engagement.
That's right. That's right. Very much so.
What brought you to Toledo?
My predecessor here had spent 6 years in the city. He moved to Pittsburgh, but before he did so, he had been the fourth pastor in 5 years, so he wanted things to work well. So before he moved to Pittsburgh, he came to Anderson, where I had just moved, and they told me Toledo was my place. And I came, visited the city, caught a fresh dream of what the church could be. And that's where my story comes from, about what happened. You want me to tell that story?
Sure.
Now? the first 3 months that I was here, my wife had just had a baby, and so I couldn't move my family immediately.
Yes.
So I would just come up on weekends and stay with an elderly member named Nancy McKay. She was a good host, even though she was quite elderly. And it happened that well into this time of driving up here, she was feeding me on Sundays. And this Sunday, she sets my plate on the table and didn't put one for herself. So I said to her, any reason why you're not eating with me today? She said, I don't feel well. I said, well, come on, let me pray for you. She said, no. You know, I'm
that caught you off guard, I'm sure.
So I asked her, what's the reason you're feeling like you're feeling? Said, it's because I'm sick. I said, wow, sorry to hear that. What happened? How can I pray? She said, well, you're the one that made me sick. I said, how'd I do that? He says, you got up and said, till death do us part, that you're going to be here in Toledo. You feel that God's going to have you here for the rest of your ministry.
Wow.
Which is how it's worked out. I'm retired now and enjoying it, but I spent 60 years pastoring the same church.
So Nancy just thought, like the rest of the preachers, you just weren't going to be around very long.
Yes, that's usually the fate that happens for most of them, and the decision that most of them make. But here, they were good for me, yeah. And somehow I seemed to catch on as far as they were concerned. One of the things I learned about pastoring is find a successful one. Don't just read books and listen to lectures and all of that, but find one and learn from them. I heard so many good things about not my immediate pastor. See, there were good enough mm-hmm. things about him, but the one before him who had only been here for 6 months, but the people loved him so when I asked who was their favorite, he was the man that they all called his name. And as a result of it, he was down in Indiana, mm-hmm. got in my car and drove immediately there.
Really?
So I could spend some time with him and learn from him things. I said to him, you're quite a fisherman, I hear. He said, no, says, I don't really like fishing much at all. I said, well, they tell me you went with them every week. He says, that was to get to know them get to know me, and for them to be able to hear my ideas and help me get them over to the people.
Yeah.
I said, wow, I guess I got to learn to go fishing here. Even though I still don't like it here, but I sure went an awful lot.
Now, I understand that there was a deacon that on a trip you went fishing with him, even though you didn't like fishing?
Right. I took him with me to Mississippi.
Of all places.
Yes, and came to the name of the lake there, say, the biggest lake in the state down there. Excellent for fishing. And I would get up in the morning, take him to the fishing bank, then go do certain spiritual work I had to do there. We started a new church there. And then at noon, I would bring lunch up, and I would sit on the fishing bank and spend the afternoon me telling him my ideas about what a church could do or be in a city. On the way home that first summer, we were about halfway home when he suddenly said to me, what was that crazy idea you had about so-and-so? And I repeated it for him. He was the chairman of the board. We got back here, got in the church business meeting. He got up and said to the people, this is what we're going to do. They voted it in completely. Pastor, what do you think? I said, sounds good to me. But it was really how we got through to people initially, even though I was new in the city.
That's the way to get people to get on your side. Find somebody, well, like you said, you heard about the pastor and you went to talk to him. And he told you about fishing. He got you ready. And then you found somebody on the inside has some power.
Yes.
And a lot of people, they love it when they think it or they can sell it as their idea.
Yes.
You had to have a truly humble spirit to just sit there and listen. Because most people would have stood up and said, wait a minute.
But if you have a noble enough goal, it will make you make sacrifices that you need to make and do the things about it. Toledo had been, when we first visited, the first day I came here, my driver had been here before, but he got lost that day. We came in down the trail and past the zoo. So, Toledo's big enough to have a zoo. We wound up downtown, nice downtown. I saw the university. I mean, he traveled all through this part of the city before we finally found the church. But it enabled me to then say, this is the kind of place I'd like to spend the rest of my life. Big cities frightened me. They were too big for me. Small towns didn't challenge me. But Toledo was just the right size for me.
That sounds like the story of, the Three Bears? Three Bears. This one's too small, this one's too big, and this one is just right. When you came to town, the church was on Grand and Waite. That was a pretty good neighborhood back in the day. A lot of doctors and professionals in that neighborhood.
It was the middle class for the African-American community.
Did that help your situation?
You couldn't do any better than that at that time, even though a lot of the things we undertook to do addressed those kinds of issues. But at that time, in 1964, I went over into the Old West End. There was just, especially in the African American church, there was just growing, instead of a parsonage, for you to have your own home was just beginning. So I went over into the Old West End, found a house, and convinced the trustee board that instead of living in the parsonage, that I could buy my own house. We just make arrangements for that.
Sure.
And so actually I was the first family on Glenwood Avenue.
The first black family.
The first black family, right. And Judge Devine and Judge McElwain, the first evening after we moved in, came a knock on the door. And went to the door, and here were these two community people. And they just plainly and pretty flatly just said, "We're not moving. We're going to welcome you to this neighborhood and include you. Want you even on the board of the Old West End." And from that point on, the Old West End became, and still is, what's remarkable is, a lot of portions of the city close to downtown become all black. But it has maintained its diversity, and it's just still a very nice place to live.
It's a rather eclectic neighborhood.
Yes,
I mean,
it
you
is.
Could find some of everyone living there, every background, and it's a very interesting neighborhood. When you came to town, I mentioned that you came before the March on Washington, but we had some riots, I think around 67, 68, and there were some issues with some students over at Scott High School.
Yes.
And I think they came to talk to you.
Well, what happened was this. The morning after King was killed, the students asked for the flag to be lowered to half-mast. The principal refused. So the students walked out. They didn't walk out. They marched out and started marching through the neighborhood. At Collingwood and Bancroft, they stopped a car with white persons in it and injured those individuals as well as damaged the car. There were several hundred of them. I didn't know what was going on till my phone rang, and they told me to. It was the police department, the chief of police, said, "We need you to help us." She told me what was going on. So I got in the back of a cruiser and drove over to Robinson Junior High School. There I asked the police to let me out at the back. I didn't want the students to see me riding with the police. By this time, they were at Robinson Junior High, breaking out the windows.
Wow.
So I didn't know what am I going to say? What am I going to do? I don't know how these kids are going to react, but they're asking me to help, so I need to help. So I ran up to the front. I was young then, I could run. Up to the front of that group, just as they were getting to Robinson and starting to throw their stones and what all else was going on. Unbelievably, even though my church at that time was not a very large church, the two boys leading that march of students, both were from my church. One's mother and the other one's grandmother were very active members.
Look at God.
I ran up there to them, grabbed them both, pulled them in, and said to them, call this to a halt, or I'm going to call your mother and your grandmother. They called it to a halt. We went over to Braden Church and had a rally there, but it saved an awful lot of public damage.
Yes.
To this day, there are those from City Hall, or were in City Hall then, who ask me, what in the world did you say to those boys? I told them, no, that's a community secret. But as we know, there's nobody more respected in a community or family than your grandmother.
They had a lot of power back in those days. Sometimes it makes me wonder when I see young people lashing out against their maternal parents, because that was a different period.
Yes.
You didn't want anyone to mention anything.
They didn't dare do so.
Not at all. If you got in trouble at school, you got in trouble when you got home.
That's
again.
Right.
But there was also another person that was well listened to back in those, and that was the pastor.
Yes.
So that's why they called you.
And I had just become president of the NAACP, just ahead of that. So it was a new experience for me, but it worked. When we had the housing ordinance here, it got voted down by the city. So we said we're going to protest. Even some black leaders, I was the president of NAACP, but there were other leaders in the group who said, that's not necessary, and went on the news to say it wasn't necessary. The news came to my door and said, what are you going to do with a divided group? I said, no problem. I said, we're still going to march. If there's nobody but five people, I had four kids, at that time, just three. Lisa, whatever it was. My children and my wife and myself, I said, we'll march, and that's good enough for me. We had over 500 people show up out there.
That's phenomenal.
That day, and had an excellent march for our cause. And that's, I think, kind of when the black community said, there's something to this man. He isn't just talking. He really means it. My leaders were so unhappy with some of the other leaders in the NAACP, called a special meeting to vote on whether I could continue as president. And I was affirmed by a majority. And yet the next day, we left to go to New Jersey, where the NAACP convention was being held, to receive the award as the outstanding chapter in the country. So you knew you had to deal with Toledo, but at the same time, somebody was going to appreciate what you were doing.
That's outstanding. One day, you're sitting in a room wondering if you're going to get voted out, and the next day, you're being recognized for your leadership and guiding
leadership.
That spirit to the next level.
Yeah.
Nationally. That's remarkable. Color of Compromise, the Black and Brown Coalition. You're still active with a lot of organizations even today.
Well, yes. I refuse to accept the presidency of anything else here. But I try to stay active and help any way that I can. It's a struggle for me for some of those meetings just to make the meetings now. But I got good experience with them, found out there were certain things that appealed to people, and sought to pursue them and share them with others. And they've worked out pretty well. I'm happy and satisfied with it.
Now, COVID affected so many churches and caused the numbers to drop a little bit. Well, some churches actually went out. You've always been innovative. I think your church, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you had the first McDonald's. You guys were involved in probably the first black groceries, full service grocery store here, Black Giant, I think that was. What would you say to today's church in terms of reaching out? And how are you guys able to get into businesses like that as a church? Because that's not typical.
Well, the church and the community walked a little more hand in hand than they do now, especially since the pandemic. There's been a shifting in the attitude and the presence, very presence, of African Americans in the church. And several churches have ceased to do business. Others don't have nearly the crowd or the finances that they had. But back in our day, to me, the 60s and 70s were the most exciting time in the life of a community. There was so much going on that you could jump in almost anywhere and find something very worth your time and your energy. And so I shouldn't say took advantage of it, but we utilized that back then. Churches could draw good numbers. Pastors were much more respected as community leaders. People knew you, respected you, and would cooperate with you. That was one of the biggest and best things that would happen then. So that, and as I said, there's such a tradition for it. You realize that King and Abernathy and all of the preachers who had done such an excellent job of risking their lives, of not being afraid or ashamed to make the steps that need to be made, even though we had Martin Luther King here on an occasion, and it just so happened that we had lunch with him and asked him questions and listened to his stories. And there were some outstanding stories, but to realize that how many times he thought he would never live beyond that day. And it wasn't just in the Deep South. In fact, he says the most frightened he was of a crowd was in Cicero, Illinois, outside of Chicago, was the most frightening experience that he had. And it kind of shocked us because we figured, you know, with all that was happening across the South, they could easily trump whatever would happen in those places. But he said That's where the worst hate and the threat to human life he felt really was for African Americans.
He took a lot of chances, but the chances that he took opened the doors for us.
Very much so.
And enabled us to be able to sit here today and do something like this. So I'm appreciative of all of those that have gone before. I'm appreciative to you. And I tell people all the time, I preached my first sermon at First Church of God when I did my first, I think it was Easter speech or Christmas speech.
Okay.
And then my aunt, who was a strong member, Sylvina Smith and Robert Smith, she taught me how to pray. She said, you ever pray before? Get out on your knees. I don't know if Miss Moore is still around or not. Peggy Moore.
She moved to Tennessee, but she's deceased now.
Okay. Well, she was my Sunday school teacher, took no mess.
She was excellent. I tell you, she was one of those. One of the good things is that in the church, there are things that individuals accomplish. But for some reason, people give credit to the pastor for having it. And one of the things I learned early was to give people opportunity to grow and go. And Peggy Moore was one of those persons who really made a difference as far as First Church was concerned. And we just tried to build on it after she had left. We were blessed, and she started, as you know, her own church.
Right.
But she really was good for us, for music and for just a quality of spiritual life for a professional.
Yes.
And that was one of the things that we aimed for, that Christ is not simply good for the poor. He's good for all God's children. When I came to town and in that neighborhood of Grandin Waite, with those families that were there, we still have a number of lawyers in the church there at First Church, because I really felt like these people, religion, Christianity, is not simply for the down and out who need God just to help them get meals for that day. But people who have some means never grow beyond the need, the spiritual need that's there. And that's why First Church wound up with so many people. I specifically went after them and convinced them that they needed. Year before last, a gentleman well known in this community, perhaps you were in the IMA meeting when he said, as he's been after me for 25 years, he says, I've finally made that move to his church and got baptized. I don't know whether you were there for that, not this past meeting, but a month ago.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Beverly, though, it was just my passion to just, I could have, some people say I should have been a lawyer, but those guys turned me on a great deal. I just liked fellowshipping with them and dealing with them. Judge McConnell was one of my first converts in the church when he was a high school teacher here going to law school. I just liked him and went after him and was not going to let him alone until he made a decision one way or the other here.
Well, I would imagine that there are a lot of people that would testify that when they got into your presence, they talked to you, they followed your direction, they would say they made the right decision.
I trust so. I made the right decision in coming to Toledo. It was the right size for me and for raising a family it's worked out well for us, and I'm just grateful to God for the chance I've had to be received here in Toledo, Ohio.
Well, I thank you for taking the time and sitting down and speaking with us. You know, as we're bringing this thing to conclusion, any final thoughts or any thoughts on the vision of where the nation is going? Because you came through a turbulent time.
Yes, but you had hope and confidence. That's part of what we've kind of lost through here. This last election did not help in that whole area. But I pray every day and believe that God's going to step in, that African Americans, even if it requires the church to rise up again, I'm going to do my best to pray for us to, you know, America has been has too much possibility for not only ourselves, but even for the rest of the world, for some of what's happening to continue. So I pray that things will turn around and that it will be a great nation, and this will be a wonderful country. Toledo will be a wonderful city, and just living will be a great experience for us all.
Well, it's been a great experience talking to you. Thank you, Bishop Culp.
Thank you.
I want to thank Bishop Culp for joining us today. And you heard him say Lisa, his daughter Lisa, is in the studio with us. So we want to thank her for being the chauffeur today and helping Bishop to get around. I'm your host and producer, C. Jerome Graham. Our executive producer is Mr. Chris Pfeiffer. If you have any questions, comments, or you just want to listen again, go to wgte.org/hope or wherever you stream your podcasts.